Hello, thanks once again for taking the time to download and listen to a podcast from CelticUnderground.net, especially after this past week. This is podcast number 207. This week I once again take the easy route and do nothing but introduce and then end the podcast. And it is St. Anthony who once again takes the reins. He meets with, and chats all things Celtic with Stephen O'Donnell, author of the excellent book Paradise Road, which St. Anthony also did a review of just before Christmas. So, rather than listen to me rant on, I will let the two gents do the talking. So this is me, Harry Brady, saying goodnight, speak to the end, and this is him, St. Anthony.
This is St. Anthony here with another podcast, and I'm delighted to welcome Stephen O'Donnell to the podcast. Stephen is the author of the excellent Celtic book Paradise Road, which we reviewed on the site just before Christmas, and we made a wee promise that we would get together after the new year and discuss the book. But as always, we'll start with the traditional question is, Stephen, who was your first hero and what was your first Celtic game?
I'm just a wee bit too young to remember Dalglish, but after that came Paul McStay, and he was kind of my hero throughout the 80s and into the 90s when I started going to the games more. So I would say Paul McStay, yeah.
Paul McStay? Mm. And what about you? What's the first game that you remember then? What's the first thing you remember?
I remember going to the Juventus game in 1981, I think it was. That was in the European Cup. And I remember all the Celtic fans were cheering for Leon Brady at the start of the game. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't understand this because he was playing for Juventus and I didn't understand. I was too young to understand why they were cheering for a guy from the other side. But yeah, that was great. That was my first experience at Celtic Park, just walking out into the jungle at the time. My dad and my uncle and my cousin. And I was staying in Kilmarnock at the time, and I'd been to a couple of games at Rugby Park that they just take you down to, you know, that wee small ground, and then all of a sudden I was right in the middle of Celtic Park for a European night. So it was great.
You tend to forget that the standing in a terrace with a crowd on about you, it's far different than sitting in an all-seated stadium. I mean, the Celtic Park was full on the days for a European game or an Old Firm game. Certainly had a wonderful atmosphere, and it was something special about being able to move about rather than sit in the same seat.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. I mean, I remember it, my cousin telling me stories that, you know, he'd been at semi-finals at Hampden and other games where he used to, like, Celtic scored, he'd be like 20 yards further forward from, you know. But yeah, obviously all that changed recently. But I still kind of miss it, you know, the old, and hopefully they'll be able to maybe reintroduce it, a bit of the standing room.
Well, they're talking about safe standing at the moment, I think. Celtic clubs seem to be quite keen on it.
They do, yeah.
So we'll need to see how that would progress. So if we move on to the book then, the book can best be described as Celtic fiction, because obviously you've got a different view. You're writing about from a different viewpoint. You're not writing about a game or a player or a particular season. So I just wonder, what gave you the idea for a fictional book about which relates to Celtic and Celtic fans?
Yeah, well, I just went for that old maxim, you know, write about what you know. And, you know, when I decided that was what I would like to do, try and get a novel out there and try and get a novel published, then it was kind of a wee bit, you know, the choice was kind of made for me. Because by that stage I'd sort of started following Celtic more regularly, going to games, following them at a distance because I wasn't always in Glasgow, and it just seemed like an obvious subject to write about. So that's what I did, and basically because I wasn't living in Glasgow the whole time, I used to come back and visit relatives. And that's when we used to go to games with my cousin, all his mates. Sometimes I'd go for nights out as well, and it was just basically the whole experience. So that was basically what I was trying to catalogue in the book. But so it goes on to sort of paint a portrait, if you like, of the young working class male Catholic West of Scotland Celtic supporter. So it's basically a portrait of their character and experiences.
Yeah, yeah. And how would you start a book like that then? What was the first thing that came to mind? Or obviously you're talking there about your own experiences, but is it a hard thing to get a storyline and or is that something that came first?
No. See, the story doesn't really drive it. It's the kind of exploration of the society and the culture of football supporters in Glasgow at the time, which was obviously used to be a very industrial city. So it's kind of now we're in a post-industrial world where all the kind of manufacturing and heavy industries that used to sustain these communities.
That comes across in the book quite well, because the main character is a guy called Kevin McGarry, and he is comparing his experiences in life to maybe his dad's generation.
That's it. Yeah.
His dad had full employment. His dad had, you know, like a trade behind him. He followed Celtic in a better era, to be honest.
And
I think he's a wee bit envious of the community spirit that his father might have enjoyed.
Yeah, he kind of laments the loss of that and the camaraderie and the solidarity of the old days. And of course, as all that industrial kind of society has been replaced by the manufacturer has been replaced by retail sector and services sector. Mm-hmm. And so that the book kind of asks these questions: what is it like for a guy who was brought up by his parents who, you know, experienced all that, and it's in a changed world now. So what is the role of young working class guys in a post-industrial society?
Mm-hmm.
And obviously Kevin McGarry's he's got the added burden of being a rejected ex-footballer, and how does he fit into this as well? He's lucky, he's one of the lucky ones. He's got a full-time job, but a lot of his mates don't.
Mm-hmm.
So kind of that's the kind of perspective he gets on it.
Mm, because obviously his friends come into it as well, and they're quite diverse and you know their likes and their fortunes and misfortunes in life.
Yeah, that's right.
Some of them have had a tough deal in life.
Some of them have, and some of the others are kind of, you know, maybe quite standard working class backgrounds, and then one or two others is more kind of middle class background. Mm. There's kind of university educated guys in there as well, so it's kind of a portrait of the whole community.
Mm-hmm. So how long would a book like yours take to write then? Obviously, if you're writing a Celtic book about maybe a certain player, then you've got the facts in front of you and you can maybe rattle through it fairly quickly, but if you're talking about fiction, then you might have to think about the storyline and what kind of ending is it going to be, and you know, so what would you be talking about for how long would that have to?
Well, the problem with the first book is you're constantly rewriting it, so you're maybe writing a chapter, you've got a couple of chapters together, you know where it's going, you send off sample chapters to some agents and publishers, you get it sent back, and then you do rewrites again, and all the time it's difficult because you're not making any kind of progress as you see it, and nobody's paying you, you're not getting any, you know, it's not like a normal day job, so you've got to keep at it really, and it can take a long time. I mean, it took me a good couple of years to actually finish the book, and then I went back and rewrote it.
Mm-hmm.
And I was sent it off to some more people, and then eventually somebody said, I like this, send us in the completed manuscript, and then that takes a long process as well, so you're rewriting it, so it's hard to say how long it
from beginning to end, but
you're talking
years, obviously.
It is years, probably about 4 years. Maybe a little bit more, but it shouldn't take that long. I mean, I kind of got distracted and things like this. But so the second book that I've written, which is now complete, that took 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
And even that, you know, should have been quicker. If I'd been more organised and disciplined, I would have written that in about 18 months at the most. But you can't write a book in a year, but the first one usually takes
a wee bit longer.
I think I heard somebody saying that if you're really dedicated to writing, then it might take you 10 years to get your first book published, and then if you're prepared to stick at it for that long.
I suppose there's a sense of perfection as well. You read it, you try and improve it, then you read it again, and you maybe each time you read it, you think of something else to change.
You do. You're always thinking of new ideas. You're always thinking of ways to improve it. And in a book like this, which is kind of set in Glasgow, and it's got a lot of Glaswegian dialect. You're always thinking of better ways to express things, and so you can always go back and rewrite, like, you know, individual sentences, and you could eventually, you know, you could never finish it. So at some point you've got to call a halt and say, this is a version I'm happy with. The publisher's now happy with it. I found a publisher. Let's go with it.
Yeah. So we were saying there about the main character's Kevin McGarry. So how much of yourself would you say that is in the character? Because
aye.
You know, when you're writing something, you tend to write, I would imagine you tend to write for your own experiences.
To a large extent you do, but you've got to fictionalise it as well. So, I mean, I'm from the west of Scotland myself, but mm-hmm. I moved away from the area when I was quite young, and we kept moving around in different places. My dad's job kept us on the move a bit. But I kept coming back to Glasgow on holidays mm-hmm. to visit relatives and, you know, my wider family. So what I was basically doing in the book is imagining a life that I might have had if those factors at a young age beyond my control had obviously been different and I had stayed and grown up exclusively in the Glasgow area, like the rest of my family. So that's the fictional element for me. So I've just written this book about something that might have happened to me if those factors beyond my control had been different, and if it had been like Kevin McGarry in the book, he's one of the most talented known footballers of his generation in Scotland. So you can add in those fictional elements as well, because I wasn't that good.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, you can fictionalise it, but a lot of it's based on, you know, guys you meet, things you've seen, things that have happened to you.
People you've met,
things you pick up. And, you know, it's not about what you can make up so much as stuff you can retain. Mm-hmm. If you see something on a night out that stays in your mind and then you can fictionalise it in some way and elaborate on it, then that's a great process. That's the creative process. Mm. That's how it works.
I think the thing that I found interesting about the book is it's written in Kevin's own words. Uh-huh. So it's an easy book to read from that point of view, because it's his thoughts and it's his sort of like beliefs and his outlook in life. And there was one part that struck me as quite poignant, was that the fact that he was comparing Scottish football to Welsh rugby and West Indian cricket. There might be people listening, especially younger guys, who won't appreciate that. Certainly for myself, when I was growing up in the 1970s, Wales had the best rugby team, the West Indies had the best cricket team, and Scotland had a damn good football team that probably, maybe never quite achieved their true potential, but nevertheless, we could.
Every club had great players, you know.
Yeah, but even at national level, we were qualifying for World Cups.
That's it.
So the whole thing is, now you look at it, and the Welsh are okay at rugby. The West Indians don't seem to be any good at cricket, and to be honest, apart from Celtic's European exploits, the Scottish national team, Scottish teams in Europe don't do so good now. So these were small countries, and you know, when you compare it to now, and you think, well, money and the increase in the professionalism in the game, certainly in rugby, isn't it? That is any good?
No, I think
that was notable. But reading that,
I think particularly with small countries like Scotland, Wales, in the past it used to be all about the sport.
Yeah,
it used to be all about the game.
The pride of the jersey and playing for your country.
And football players, rugby players, they were like heroes of their community, and now they're kind of, you know, seen as kind of overpaid. I mean, they're still admired in their own way, but, you know, they're also a lot of envy, and, you know, they're seen as, rather than heroes of the community, they're seen as arrogant, overpaid, you know, what can I use, you know? they're not so highly regarded. And I think that shift, right about the Sky era, you know, when Sky came into English football and started drowning it in money, I think that kind of undermined Scottish football in a way that hasn't really recovered from. Welsh rugby has recovered a wee bit. They've embraced the whole new professional era, and there's a long time there when we went through a big slump, and it's still not the same and as good as it used to be. And West Indies cricket hasn't recovered, Scottish football hasn't recovered, and you know, we're going to be welcoming Fergus McCann to Celtic Park, I think, is coming next year, and he's been hailed as a hero, and, you know, rightly so, but he was the guy who kind of took Celtic out of the old era into the new era, which needed to happen, but at the same time, it's not quite as clear-cut as that, because you know, in the past Celtic won the European Cup. I don't know whether we're close to that now because in the era of financial power in football, it's just can't happen.
I always think the biggest problem in Scottish football that we've got is terms of geography. We're right next to England, who's such a big monster in the football game, and since the Sky live satellite television has came upon us that it's not unusual to maybe sit and watch Manchester United play Liverpool on a Monday night and watch Real Madrid play Barcelona the Wednesday night for the comfort of your own living room. So years ago, there was a wee bit of, there was something exotic about European football, mm-hmm. which you don't get now. Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes it's unfair to compare our product with theirs because you're not comparing like to like.
Aye, well, I mean, I love it. I watch as much football as anybody, you know. Mm-hmm. Like you say, it's on most nights of the week, and I love it. But yeah, I think in the past, you weren't watching, you know, not just us, but the players themselves, they weren't watching, you know, European football every night of the week. They were relying on their coaches to tell them how to play against these teams because, they'd never seen them play. Mm-hmm. So there was no question of, oh, how do we pit our wits against this, you know, the way that the Spanish play the game. You just played your natural game. Mm-hmm. You just went out, you played your natural game, and you imposed it on the other team, and they, if they were any good, they'd be doing the same to you. It was a clash of styles, and it was just whoever won on the day, whoever was the best team, whoever could impose their game on their opponents in a way that they're not used to facing in their maybe domestic league. Mm-hmm. But now we're kind of over-analysing it a lot, and we think that our game is inferior, whereas in actual fact, when we're at our best, it's just we're forgetting about, you know, the strengths and weaknesses of our opponents and just like imposing our game on all comers.
I think the going thing about the comparison with English is that you get these teams in England that get the automatic money from the TV money. You're talking maybe in something in the region at least about £30 million. Mm-hmm. So certainly when we were kids and we were growing up, okay, McCarrie went to Man United, Dalglish went to Liverpool, Nicholas went to Arsenal. But at least they were going. They were. I wouldn't say they were improving themselves, but they were going to a similar big club in a big city. Mm-hmm. Now you've got guys like Gary Hooper going to Norwich and Joe Lively going to Crystal Palace, and I just despair because Celtic are such a much bigger club than them. We should have a platform for the guys to be happy. They shouldn't need to go anywhere else.
Yeah. But I don't know. I think it's the league that they're leaving rather than the club. Mm-hmm. Hooper's English, he wants to play in the Prem. I remember him tweeting about great feelings scoring in the Premiership. But he must scratch his head at some point and think, what have I done here? Because he's left Celtic and he's at Norwich. Yeah, it's a bigger league, but the club, size of the club doesn't compare. And Joe Ledley as well, I was surprised when Joe Ledley left because he always said he enjoyed it at Celtic, he appreciated what the club meant to the supporters and how big it was, and he's Welsh as well, so he didn't need to go back to England to prove himself, because it's not his country, like Hooper. I remember reading, I think it might have been Strachan or a previous manager or anyway, saying that there's a lot of people that have left Celtic, but not a lot of them actually end up being glad that they have. Mm-hmm. So I think they get tempted away by playing in the Premiership in England, maybe probably more money, fair play to them, but at some point they must wonder what they've done. Mm-hmm. Especially in Champions League nights.
Well, Hooper certainly, I think, would be pretty envious. Mm-hmm. Looking up the road and seeing the stadium fit to burst and when you're maybe enjoying a relegation dogfight than in England.
Well, Ledley might be in the Championship next season.
The Duran could be, if they're not careful.
Well, Celtic are playing in the Champions League.
Be careful what you wish for.
Yeah.
Getting back to the book there, the book is written and it's the thoughts and the feelings of Kevin McGarry in his own mind. And he also touched upon politics and religion in it. And I wonder, did you find that was controversial? Is that something that came easily?
It wasn't as difficult as you might think. I mean, it was an area that had never been explored before and never been touched upon in any book that I'd ever read before. So that's where I wanted to go when I realised that. I think, right, if I'm going to write a book, then I need to go somewhere that I've not seen done before. And obviously there's other books that I was influenced by, but I wanted to go there. I wanted to explore the character and the culture of West of Scotland, Tims, for want of a better word, And that meant expressing views that you might hear in the pub or wherever, on the terraces, or the, formerly on the terraces, in the stands now. So you get a lot of Kevin McGarry's thoughts on sectarianism and
the politics,
nature of society, what's happened to, what's changed in football. So all these things come into it, and you know, sometimes I put it at that in a kind of train of thought, kind of monologue, where you kind of you know, take you away from the narrative and the situation for a wee while, and you get Kevin's ideas and these things, Catholic schools, whatever, and then it comes back into the dialogue and the situation. So yeah, I mean, that's what good books do. I think they, you know, they give you the kind of main characters' thoughts, and obviously some of that is kind of my views as well. But it's got to be expressed in a way that it comes across as your fictional characters' views, and they've got to sound like representative of, you know, people like him.
Is it there tended to be a stereotype through the years that Celtic fans were, in the main, were Catholic, in the main, were working class, in the main, were Labour voting. But I notice on the websites these days that there's a wee sort of, certainly no civil war, but there's maybe like people who are pro-independence and people who are maybe not sure about it. And you know, there's certainly a wee divide out there. It's quite interesting to see how things are developing.
Yeah, well, I think a lot of Celtic fans are heading towards yes and the independence vote, and that takes them away from their former home, if you like, and the Labour Party. I think a lot of, like you're right, the Catholic socialist, I would say, rather than you know, Labour, but Labour was obviously identified with socialism back in the day. That's not necessarily the case now, so I think a lot of them are looking around for some form to express themselves in another way, some other party that's maybe going to represent their views, and that doesn't necessarily seem to be the views of the modern Labour Party. And maybe the SNP is I mean, a lot of people who aren't necessarily nationalists, never mind, you know, Scottish nationalists, are obviously turning the SNP now in a way that they would kind of, they've never dreamed of before.
Times are obviously changing in that respect.
As
I said, your book can be described as Celtic fiction, and it's quite interesting because there was a book released last year called The Road to Lisbon by, I think it was Tom Gregg and Charles McGarry. Off the top of my head,
Martin Gregg, I think.
Martin Gregg, you're right.
I've got it on my Kindle. I've not read it yet, Stephen. So.
It's a great book, and I found your book reminiscent in the respect that theirs was the feeling of a Celtic fan in the 1960s and what he was going through, but yours obviously is in the modern era, and it's interesting to see the contrast between the two. And I'm sure you'll enjoy it, but it goes to show as well how the Road to Lisbon did very well last year, and hopefully your book did well also. So there's maybe a wee market out there for that kind of thing.
Oh, I think there is. I mean, certainly the response I've got has been very positive, and like the sales have been good, but only among Celtic fans so far. I mean, I've not got the book out there in the wider market, which hopefully is the next kind of stage or step for it. But yeah, I've not read Road to Lisbon. When you're actually writing, you don't get to read as much as you'd like, and I've just finished a second book, so but that's definitely on my reading list, and it'd be interesting to see how it compares, because normally you would read these kind of books as kind of research for your own work, so that's one I've got to read still. But yeah, hopefully there is a kind of market for Celtic fiction, football fiction, because, you know,
Well, we're talking there about David Peace.
We were. I mean, I've sent it to a couple of other fanzines. I mean, it's been in Not The View, and I sent it to a couple of other fanzines of clubs down in England as well, and they've reviewed it as well, and they're very positive about it as well. So it was that guy who read it in a Middlesbrough fanzine and reviewed it, and he really enjoyed it, and he didn't understand too much about, you know, what the kind of scene in the west of Scotland, the football scene, until he read the book, and it kind of educated him as well.
What kind of reception would you get for an English guy from Middlesbrough that's reading the Glasgow dialect? Because it's an easy book for me to read, because it's just like the way I think, the way I speak, so obviously like I can get the gist of it right away.
Well, all he told me was that he loved it. I mean, I remember when I read Trainspotting for the first time, it took me a couple of pages to get into it, and then I was away.
You get an eye for it.
Aye, you do. You get an ear for it and an ear for it. So I think that's what happened with him, and And the feedback has been brilliant. I mean, I'm on social media, and like people are getting back to me with it. Great feedback. It's been like I've had loads of good reviews on the Celtic sites, including Celtic Underground. That was a brilliant review as well. So it's just great to get that positive feedback. That's why you do it. Really.
The Christmas market for Celtic books was really, really competitive this year. I sort of pride myself in reading all the Celtic books through the years, and I've got a huge collection in the house, and I don't remember a time where I read so many good ones one after another. Now we did four. It was actually myself that did four reviews for the site. There was Sean Farn's book, there was the Road to Lisbon book, there was yourself, and there was Richard Purden's book, Faithful Through and Through. And each in their own way, they were absolutely excellent. And when you're writing a review, sometimes you think to yourself, you know, oh, this is going to be good, because you know, like, you would like to give it a positive slant. But that was four books that it was A, so easy to read, and B, easy to be positive about in a review. But I was thinking there that with the Christmas market being so competitive, is that something you were aware of when the book was coming out, that you would be up against so many others?
I knew who it was up against, yeah. I mean, it's like I say, it's great. And I think a lot of Celtic fans are turning to Celtic books and are enjoying reading them. So mine's obviously a wee bit different from a lot of them that was out there. There was a lot of biographies of Celtic players and Celtic, you know, Sean Farrell, the Celtic coach. A lot of fans' experiences. Mine's obviously straight fiction, so in that regard, it's more similar to The Road to Lisbon, I guess. So it was a wee bit different from the others, but at the same time, I knew the others that were out there, and a lot of people kind of grab a Celtic book for a relative for Christmas. And a lot of them went for the Paradise Road, and because they'd heard it was good, and they had the positive feedback, and so that was great. It did all right at Christmas.
I actually think they've got a very educated support. I don't say that in a boastful way. I genuinely mean that when you look at the guys like through the years, like David Potter and Tom Campbell and Pat Woods, who were the traditional book writers, if you like, and they brought all this stuff out, and now you're beginning a new wave of guys that like, you know, guys like yourself and Richard Purden and Paul Dykes are bringing out really Stephen Sullivan, and you're all, I mean, this is a compliment, younger. You know, you're a new wave, if you like guys who are writing about Celtic. Yeah. And when you think of the quality of stuff that we've had through the years, and that's carrying on, it's absolutely outstanding.
I think there's a new wave of new Celtic books. I mean, you can see them on Amazon. When you know, you get the Amazon rankings, and they're all listed as Celtic books now, so they all come in the category, and they're jumping up. Whenever somebody buys it, you jump up a few places in the Celtic book listings. And there's so much competition out there, so many good books. Like you say, back in the day, it used to be, you know, the Celtic histories by guys like Pat Woods, Tom Campbell. Now I think there's much more diversity. You can there's a whole load of Celtic books to choose from, and not all of them are published by you know, regular publishers now. You can publish yourself.
It's also noticeable that some of the Celtic players are bringing out biographies now that might not have in the past. And I'm thinking maybe the likes of that, there was a good one that was out there, Willie Wallace, that was a great book that was released last summer. Now Willie Wallace might only been 5 years with Celtic, and he's always been lying, he's a legend.
Kicky boy, he's from Cuttantillock.
Absolutely.
I got it from my dad for Father's Day last year.
And not only was it a good book, but it's nice to see, you know, like Billy McNeil's, to my knowledge, has had three autobiographies in his life. Right. And there's other guys, I think Bobby Lennox has had two, and Tommy Gamble's had a couple as well, so it's nice to see somebody different in the scene, that's got a different angle.
Those books were good. I mean, but usually do, like, I think one of the Billy McNeil's ones was like ghostwritten by a journalist and a tabloid journalist. And it's, you know, they're worth reading. But now, like you say, there's a new wave, I think, and it's a lot more you know, sophisticated, a lot more choice, and I think Celtic fans are appreciating that.
So in terms of the success of the book, are you quite pleased at how things have went?
Definitely. I mean, in terms of the feedback I've been getting from Celtic fans, the reviews I've been getting on the Celtic sites, it's, you know, it's the reason you do it. I would like the book to, you know, gain a wider audience, maybe down in England. Football fans everywhere. If you look, we've talked about the Damned United and David Peace and writers like that, John King, the Football Factory. You know, so there's definitely a market for it, and I would hope that my book would be able to break out from just the Celtic contingent that's appreciating it at the moment, and so that other people can read it and then they gain a kind of an understanding of what it's like to be a Celtic fan. And that's a lot of, you know, folk down in England, I think, would go to a book like that. But just got to spread the word, really.
There's a bit in the book you describe, it's the bus going to an Old Firm game, and it actually made me laugh out loud, because the way you describe it is you've got the older men sitting at the front, you've got the sort of the younger team at the back who are maybe smuggling a couple of bottles of beer, and maybe they've got a wee drink in them, that they want a wee sing song at the back, and there's always a faithful guy in the bus that collects the money and pays the driver, and your whole description of that just brought back the I used to be the treasurer of a supporters bus for about 8 years, and it was a bloody hard job, to be honest, but it made me smile because it brought back so many memories of things that went on.
A lot of people have said that. They've said that, you know, it sounds authentic.
Very authentic.
Well, that's great. That's what I was aiming for. Right? So that's good.
And in terms of sales, did you have a target in mind? Are you happy with how really. It's been?
Not really. Like I said, it's sold mostly among Celtic supporters so far. Just over 1,000 books. Probably, maybe they get handed out to, you know, if somebody's read it, they'll hand it to their mate to read as well. So it's impossible to tell how many folks actually read it. I've got another book coming out later in the year, so hopefully they'll, you know.
That brings me on to the next question, is going to be what's your future projects? So, what's the book?
Well, at the moment, I'm still trying to publicise the first one, because, like I say, it's a small publisher that published it, and me and my girlfriend are kind of having to do most of the publishing ourselves.
The Paradise Road book, if there's anybody listening and they're interested in the book, what's the easiest way to get it?
Several ways to get it. It's in the Celtic shops. If you walk in the Superstore on match day, it's right in front of you. It's the first thing you see when you walk in the door now. I don't know whether they've rearranged it since the St Burn game the other night. I don't think so, but it's been there for a couple of weeks, certainly over Christmas. And they've got it in quite a few of the other Celtic shops as well. Definitely in Argyle Street. Waterstones have got it across Scotland. Other bookshops like kind of order it as and when the orders come in. But Amazon's where most people get it. So Amazon just put a 20% discount on it just after Christmas there. So you can get the ebook on Amazon and you can get the paperback on Amazon as well.
Good stuff. So you were going to talk there about your future project. What's the next thing you've got in mind?
Yeah, well, I've got a second book that I've been writing over the last year or so. So that's completed now, and that's going to be published in June.
What's the subject matter for that then?
The subject is one of the minor characters in the first book, in Paradise Road. He's living over in Prague in the first book.
Oh, yeah.
And he comes home for the start of the second book, and he's the narrator for the second book, Peter Fitzpatrick.
So it's Kevin's pal, really?
Kevin's pal, Peter Fitzpatrick. He comes back from Prague, he's got his Czech wife with him. And he's looking around for something to do. He used to be involved in financial services before he went away, but there's obviously the credit crunch has hit, and he doesn't want to get back into that. So he's looking around for something to do, and he has this idea of approaching the national broadcaster with an idea to present a television programme discussing any and all matters relating to Scottish football. And his pitch is that he's seen these shows done in other countries that he's lived in, and they're always done like intelligently, really well, seriously.
Not like the stuff we get here.
Exactly, not like the stuff we get here, and that's his pitch, so it'll be distinctive and different, and he can bring these kind of new high standards to Scottish football, and he hopes that that'll improve, you know, the if you discuss Scottish football more intelligently, then it can have a positive influence on the game. So, I don't want to give away the story, but basically...
Will there be a Celtic slant to this one?
Well, he's a Celtic supporter.
I could make a wee joke here and say he's got no chance in the media.
Well, this is it. So I play up on these kind of stereotypes and these kind of, you know, ideas that, you know, the media is a wee bit biased against Celtic. So he somehow gets himself in there. And then... you know, things are going really well, the programme's great, everyone's saying, you know, how good it is, how refreshing it is, and then the biggest story in the history of Scottish football hits, namely...
Rangers.
The liquidation of Rangers, and it's all about how a Celtic fan is going to approach that, because he's quite openly a Celtic fan. But
he's
got
his boss is one of the reporters.
Exactly.
Also.
And he's got a Rangers man there, you know, on the panel with him in the show. So it's all balanced in that. But basically, the editorial independence that they enjoyed in the show.
Don't spoil it too much because that when it's published and printed, we'll have to have you back on and talk about it in greater detail.
Right.
Then, but it's good to know that there's something else in the pipeline.
I've recently just finished up on that one. And I'm now looking at, you know...
When will that be out? Have you got a timescale for when you'd like it for?
The publisher have told me it's going to be June. I think they've said June the 13th for the launch date, which is the first day of the World Cup, so...
Yeah.
You need to get...
So it's not far away then, is it?
Exactly. So we'll get out and we'll do the launch, and then we'll get back and watch Brazil or Croatia, I think it is.
We'll look forward to that. I'm sure there's a lot of people out there who anticipate that. That brings us on to current matters now, and we have discussed this the Friday night before the Aberdeen game on the Saturday. Now, the thing about this season is it's been very successful for Celtic, but a lot of people are looking forward to the match tomorrow because it's got a bit more meaning to it.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, obviously, we're I think it's 21 points in front in the league, and I think it's safe to say that the league should be in the bag. And... with it being a Scottish Cup tie and a knockout, then, as I said, people are anticipating this greatly. Maybe more so in view of the fact of the carry-on at Tynecastle with Neil Lennon last week. What was your take on that?
My take on it was stand-up, 18th minute, Mirren game, and applaud the guy.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I've done with everybody else on the ground. It's a wee bit surprising coming from Aberdeen because... they don't like Rangers particularly.
No.
And to be so good, to be behaving like Rangers fans,
I thought it was quite depressing because I've been to Pittodrie, I've been going to Pittodrie since the early 1980s. And generally speaking, when you were in the city and you were in pubs and things, Celtic and Aberdeen fans going okay, they were never going to be boos and buddies. There was especially when Alec Ferguson was there and Aberdeen had a fine team, there was a rivalry, but it was a healthy rivalry. Mm-hmm. And I think in fairness to Neil Lennon, he was quick to say last week that it wasn't a sectarian matter.
Aye.
But at the same time, it was still a pretty desperate situation where a manager can't go in peace and sit and respect and watch his future opponents play a game.
Yeah. So, I mean, I was a bit surprised, but even though you get to the stage where nothing really surprises you, but I think the Celtic fans will get up and stand up and applaud him again
this
game, 18th minute. Used to wear the number 18.
Mm-hmm.
But it's interesting to see how the Aberdeen fans react. But I think the club put out a statement pretty soon, like, you know, condemning it. So, it was
pretty lukewarm. There wasn't enough in it for me.
Mm-hmm.
So the other thing it would be there's a decent crowd anticipated tomorrow in terms of a cup tie, and Aberdeen are bringing an estimated 3,000 down to Glasgow, which will. In fairness to them, they always bring a decent support,
great.
Considering the journey that most of them have got to make.
Yeah.
So, I know tonight on Twitter they were seeing a crowd of between 30,000 and 35,000.
Great, well, aye.
So much for Armageddon.
That's right, yeah. I mean, I'll be there, yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not in the season book, but we've got tickets, you know, £15 for season ticket holders, so...
So hopefully there'll even be a big rush tomorrow morning and maybe add a few thousand on as well, but I really hope that the Celtic players are up for this because I think, certainly from my perspective, that the games took on a different slant. Last week I was looking forward to it, but this week I'm really, really anticipating it in view of what happened at Tynecastle, and I hope that the players are up for not only will they play well tomorrow, but they'll put a good fight up as well.
Yeah, well, I think the team's done brilliantly recently to not only to keep the clean sheet. Record going, but to keep putting in pretty decent performances and getting good wins at a stage where, you know, they could quite easily, you know, been going down the gears, dropping down, you know, and because, like you say, the league, you know, it's almost in sight now, but they've kept it up and it's been a great run they're on. But in a cup game, it could all, you know, if something goes wrong,
I think you could
be out on the day.
Is it 4 or 5 years ago we played Aberdeen in a replay at Celtic Park on a horrible Wednesday night and we lost 1-0? So
That was after Van Hooydonk, very good at Hisseling.
In the last
second. Got the equaliser.
So, you know, it goes to show how, you know, hopefully the team will be up for it and mentally, and in terms of their performance, they're turning a good show.
Yeah, hopefully. I mean, like you say, if there's anything good to come out of that episode, then I hope it's, you know, I hope it's on display in the pitch tomorrow.
Now, in the January transfer window there, with basically one in, one out, from the point of view in the midfield, that we lost Joe Ledley, but we said hello to Stefan Johansson. So Joe Ledley's leaving, we would be sad to see him go.
I was. A wee bit surprised as well, like I mentioned earlier. He did seem to be quite well settled here. He didn't have that kind of mentality that a lot of English players sometimes have, that, you know, they're just, you know, waiting to get back down the road. He seemed to, you know, like it up here, and he seemed to appreciate what the club means to everybody. So, a wee bit surprised to see him go, but the boy Johansson looks decent. He came on against Kilmarnock and gave the ball away with his first touch, but, you know, Henrik Larsson did that as well, didn't he? But he looked great against the man. He did look a player, so hopefully he can slot in, and, you know, we'll no miss Joe.
I think people forget that Joe Ledley showed a lot of courage signing for Celtic, because when he did come 4 years ago and he signed for Neil Lennon, he was lambasted by the Cardiff chairman at the time, who accused him of lacking ambition and other things. And I'm absolutely delighted that Joe Ledley can go back down south and say that he played something in the region of 16 Champions League games. And that's no counting the qualifiers. And obviously there was a few cup finals to boot as well, and a couple of league championship medals. So I have to say that I was sorry to see Joe go, but at the same time, he'd given his good service, and he's got many a good memory to take back to down south, and really just wishing all the best at Crystal Palace.
Mm-hmm. And if he did get £2.5 million for him, as has been reported, then that's a decent bit of business, I suppose.
Was it not 800,000?
Well,
right, to be honest, whatever you get for a guy who's out of contract 6 months.
Yeah, I mean, somebody was reporting £2.5 million, mm-hmm. but, you know, you've no idea what's accurate and what's not in the papers these days.
Moving on to Johansson there, that for me, that was one of the most impressive debuts I've ever seen for a Celtic player. I thought he was absolutely tremendous.
Yeah, he was. Looked like, I mean, he's always like a central midfielder who's gonna pass the ball, control the game. So he might dovetail quite well with Scott Brown, who's none of those things. You know, he's a different kind of player altogether. And it looks like, you know, they're playing with Charlie McGrew on the left as well. So that's a kind of three-man midfield. Like you say, it was a great debut, but interesting to see how he gets on in the Champions League next season.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the what I liked about Johansson was, he looks like the midfield player we've been crying out for. He knew when to hold on to it, he knew when to release it. Another thing that was absolutely amazing was his anticipation and positional play was immense. The number of times he broke up an attack and anticipated a pass is something that we've been lacking for a long while.
Yeah, well, they did seem quite excited to get him, Celtic, so hopefully they've got a great record of, you know, spotting players in that age bracket, in that price bracket, and bringing them on. So hopefully he's another one that's going to fit the bill.
And moving on to the forward line now, you've got your man Griffiths is with us. Unfortunately, he couldn't play last week because he wasn't signed in time. So is your glass half empty or half full when it comes to Lee Griffiths?
Well, glass is kind of give the boy a chance, you know, to see what he can do. I kind of think that he's been bought to partner Stokes.
Mm-hmm.
I think Stokes looked pretty poor against the man. You know, he was on his own up front, and he had a great partnership with Hooper, and he does seem to get the best out of Stokes when he's playing with a partner.
And
if his partner is a kind of similar kind of character to him, mm-hmm. you know, kind of mm-hmm. a mate, then he forms that kind of understanding with him, and I think Lee Griffiths might be a kind of similar kind of character to Anthony Stokes, and we might see them playing together. I think that's maybe one reason why he went out and bought him.
Mm-hmm. My worry is that Griffiths and Stokes won't get a chance to be a partnership because Commons is in such good form. Uh-huh. He's got to play Commons. There's no way
he's
can
play Commons. He's got
and he likes his four-man midfield.
Yeah.
So that's it, the problem. You've got the four-man midfield, you've got Commons in between, and you've got somebody who's a spear point up front. And that's been the problem, because Stokes is trying it, he hasn't cut it. Baldy's tried it, but to be honest, Baldy's not much of a chance. But Pookie's had plenty of chances, and he just hasn't been impressive at all.
No, not so far, no. I mean, hopefully he'll kind of come out of his shell and show what he can do. But you're right, we're still waiting to see the best of him, I think. But yeah, with McGrew on the left, that leaves, and two centre midfielders, that leaves three attacking players.
Yeah.
So if you've got, you know, if you've got Commons as one of them, then you need Forrest in there, so that kind of leaves one central striker. But I'm reckoning that he's maybe wanting to go with the two centre midfielders, and then four attackers, so you can play Stokes and Griffiths up front, and then Commons and Forrest.
So just before we close up, then, if it was you or the manager tomorrow picking the team, what would your team be?
What would my team be?
If it was your choice.
I think it's too early for Griffiths, so. Sorry. I think I'd probably put Samaras in there because Stokes.
Well, start the goalkeeper, not forward.
Right, okay. I'd put Zaluska in goal. No, I'm kidding. I'd go for Fraser Foster in goal. Fisher's done all right in right back slot, so he's the only fit right back at the moment, so I'll stick with him. Ambrose and Van Dijk are kind of picking themselves at the moment, as is Izaguirre. I think with it being a cup game, you don't want to be too experimental, so you'd stick the three in the midfield there of McGrew on the left, Johansson and Brown in the middle, probably Forrest on the right, Commons in the hole, and I'd go with Samaras up front because none of the other strikers, basically by default, you know, Lee Griffiths isn't ready. Pookie and Stokes are kind of, we're not quite seeing the best of them yet. So I think you might change. That might be his one change from the start of 11 against St Mirren. Just go with Samaras and give him a chance to show what he can do after running his contract down, and he's got the World Cup coming up. So he's got a bit to prove at the moment, I think.
A lot of people have been advocating giving Amino Baldy a chance through the centre, and he's almost went for a joke figure. Is he a guy who's becoming a cult figure with the Celtic supporters?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I thought when we signed him, I thought, right, get crosses into the box and he'll hit them in. But yeah, right, he's done that yet. I don't know. The term he uses is raw, isn't it? He's like a raw talent, so I think he's got a bit to
go. To say the least.
I think he's got a bit to go, to be fair. So, not quite yet. Maybe on the bench.
If you look at it at half time, he comes out with Danny McGrain and he practices, and it's amazing. Start. He's actually, I don't say this lightly, he's really improved. The first touch passing and the throwing the ball ahead and the chesting. At the beginning, he looked like Bambi on ice, but recently, it's obviously something they've worked on tremendously in training, and you just think, well, maybe if he gets a wee shot, he maybe take his chance.
Well, I certainly hope so. I was watching on a dodgy internet connection, the game against Galatasaray. He did alright there. So did Pookie, to be fair, and a lot of the younger players. So hopefully it can just continue, bringing through the young players, bringing through these guys that they've gone out and scouted.
So that brings us to the end then. So all it means for me to say is best of luck with the book and how it's going, and when the new book comes out, give us a wee shout and we'll have you back on, and you can explain the story behind it a wee bit further, and give you a wee plug for the new book when it comes out in June.
Certainly will do, mate. Thanks a lot.
Okay, pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that. An excellent listen. There'll be some more podcasts along soon. Just enough time for me to say that was St Anthony with Stephen O'Donnell. Details on the website of where to get the book. This is me, Harry Bariri, saying good night. Good night.
so far away. Being close to you is almost heaven. But seeing you can do just so much. It hurts me so to know your heart's a treasure. So far.